Spirit of life-giving love and love-giving life. Spirit of the storm and the calm that comes before the storm and then again after. We gather together in community this morning, having been through something of an experience. I myself have had the opportunity time and again to witness members of our community, both here in the congregation and abroad in the wider community, through acts of gentleness and kindness and caring. Help us, Spirit of life and love, to always strive for that kindness and caring and love, that we might not need challenges and difficulties in order for it to be the very next thing. Just to continue in that vein, Spirit of life, so many of the people in this room have in the past couple of weeks stood in dark rooms and walked from one dark room to another only to try to turn on the light switch in the room that they've just walked into. Let us develop the habits that we want to have in our lives so that even when those natural supports for those habits disappear, we might still behave in the ways that we aspire to be. Let us hold this moment together in quiet. Amen.
Our ancient reading this morning is from the Tao Te Ching, chapter 17, written by the Chinese sage Lao Tzu and translated by John C.H. Wu. The highest type of ruler is one of whose existence the people are barely aware. Next comes one whom they love and praise. Next comes one whom they fear. Next comes one whom they despise and defy. When you are lacking in faith, others will be unfaithful to you. The sage is self-effacing and scanty of words. When his task is accomplished and things have been completed, all the people say, "We ourselves have achieved it." Our modern reading is by novelist and nonfiction writer Anne Lamott. It is from her biographical book, Operating Instructions, a Journal of My Son's First Year. And I felt like my heart had been so thoroughly and irreparably broken that there could be no real joy again, that at best there might eventually be a little contentment. Everyone wanted me to get help and rejoin life, pick up the pieces and move on. And I tried to. I wanted to. But I just had to lie in the mud with my arms wrapped around myself, eyes closed, grieving, until I didn't have to anymore.
So, who might have guessed a month ago when I chose my sermon title for this morning, Picking Up the Pieces and Moving On, who might have known what it was that we would be thinking about this morning? Certainly not I. We all knew that the election would be this last Tuesday, but what none of us realized was that we would be less than 2 weeks out from the experience of Hurricane Sandy, reportedly one of the worst storms to hit New Jersey in the modern history. And who would have guessed that even a week after Sandy, we would be, that would be followed by the nor'easter Athena. Did you all know that it was named Athena? They used that name so sparingly. I was so pleased that they used it sparingly. Athena wasn't really all that much of a storm. She was more of an aggregation to those who were still doing without so much, without power and lights and such, let alone those who have been struggling to do without their homes. Picking up the pieces and moving on. First, the election. What we could not have known at this time last month was whether any of us would be pleased or discouraged by the outcome of the election. What we could have projected, though, was that somewhere just over half of the electorate of our country would be satisfied with the results, and nearly half of it would not. I don't imagine this room is so evenly divided, but I surely do expect that there are those representing both sentiments present here this morning. No matter what might have been our first choice, there are pieces to be picked up if we are to move on. Let me first and perhaps foremost say that I am so very pleased that we have finally reached this respite of post-election moment. I suspect this pause will be brief between the presidential campaign season that just ended and the one that's about to begin. Just the same, I'm praying that no one will be actively candidating for the 2016 position for at least a couple of weeks, if not a couple of months. That would just be too much. But that doesn't mean that we are really between political seasons. We're not. Politics is perennial in nature. There is always, it seems, time for a game of politics. The reason I'm glad that the election is behind us, though, is that because it's been so full of negativity, almost too much to bear, what ought to be one of our proudest democratic processes has evolved into one of our most sordid circus maximus kinds of sagas. I'm not saying this hasn't always been the case. Throughout American history, there have been periods of brutal presidential politicking. I'm just saying that it feels like it's intensified and worsened over the past couple of decades. Contestants for one of the most significant offices in the entire world are reduced to some of the worst banal and derisive playground behaviors imaginable. We all recognize that there is a great deal at stake. The economy is at stake. The environment is at stake. Justice, tranquility, common defense, general welfare, the security of our future generations, not just for this country, but the future generations of the world, all of those are at stake. It must be, I'm sure, hard to be noble when so much is at stake. But just the same, when nobility is squandered in our highest political arena, all the rest of those very lofty principles and aspirations, all the rest of them are cheapened. And so for years, the predominant product coming out of our nation's capital has been intractable impasse. So much is at stake, it seems the thinking goes, that if my view, if my narrative, if my agenda cannot be the primary driver of our nation's policies, I will use any means, take any measures possible to ensure that no other view or narrative or agenda has the opportunity to move the country in the direction of that narrative. So at this point, we're no longer talking, really, about presidential politics. We're no longer talking just about Congress either. We're talking about us. We're talking about the citizens of this country. We're talking about us, the people who are gathered here in this room right now. We're talking about red states and blue states, about conservatives and liberals. We're talking about tolerance and intolerance. But primarily what we're talking about is intolerance. When I was up in Boston last weekend, I ended up for a few minutes on last Sunday afternoon driving alone in a car, and I was listening to last week's episode of This American Life, yet another one of my favorite National Public Radio shows. How many of you listened to This American Life? How many of you caught last week's? Oh, good. We can do a fact check on this afterwards. The theme of the show was on the same subject of this great American divide that we're talking about here this morning. And the focus was very similar also to one that some of us approached a few weeks ago in our senior lunch bunch. Our focus on that divide was how in such a politically fragmented environment can a person have a meaningful conversation with someone whose views are so diametrically opposed to their own? How can you do that? How can you talk with someone on the other side of that gulf? I have to admit that my own perception that I shared with the senior lunch bunch was a very cynical one. I was preaching abstinence to our seniors. Better off, I thought and said, to just keep one's mouth shut when the presence of the opposition was at hand. But the producers of This American Life had higher aspirations than I did. They found a couple of guys who had worked together in the hope that they might develop a model for just such conversations. Both of them were politically aware. One of them was a Republican and one was Democrat. In their work together, they established two criteria that might allow for successful conversations. One, that both parties wanted to be in conversation with the other. Important. And two, that neither party would try to convert the other. The effort would not be to persuade, but to understand. The producers also found two sisters, a couple of women who sounded like they might be sexta or septuagenarians, and one of them was a Democrat and a staunch liberal, the other was a self-described conservative Republican. And the interviewer talked individually and alternately with these two women, and it seems that over the years they had grown stronger in their political positions, but weaker in their ability to be civil with one another. They both admittedly loved one another. Neither of them wanted to say hurtful things to the other, so they had just stopped talking altogether with each other. The sisters agreed to have a recorded conversation with each other, and it would be moderated by these two guys that had created the model. Shortly before that conversation was to take place, though, the conservative sister backed out. She said that she was just too afraid that she would say something so spiteful to her sister that they might never be able to bridge the gulf that would be created. It just isn't worth the risk, she said. So the producers convinced her, as long as her liberal sister would not be present, would not be a part of the conversation, they convinced her to go ahead and have a conversation with the two guys by herself anyway. And the part of the conversation that aired was between the conservative sister and the liberal partner of the team, okay? So he asked her, what are you so afraid that you might say to your sister that would be so awful, that would be so hurtful? And so she told him. She said that she found liberals to be the most selfish people that she could conceive of. She said her sister had never been like that. She'd never been a selfish person, but then she became a liberal, and so she must be just as selfish as all the other liberals. The guy explained to her that selfishness was her perception of liberals, and it might be a perception that was not a shared reality as much as she supposed that it was. And then he asked the woman, what gives you the impression that liberals are so selfish anyway? Well, she said, the proof is that liberals don't really want to help anyone except themselves. I was stunned. People need help, she said. Everyone knows that, but liberals are so selfish, they don't want to help people. They want the government to do that for them so that they don't have to do it. They want the government to do it so they don't have to. It was an aha moment for me. I don't know how your perception of what she's saying is, but it was an aha moment. Through this woman's perception, I could see that there was plenty of room for two very different appreciations of the same experience, of the same phenomenon. Why do liberals want programs? So that they don't have to do it themselves. Both of these views are quite reasonable. If everyone can agree that there will always be those among us who are in need of help, of course there'll be different views on how we accomplish helping them. If we can accept that, then we can work together to come up with the best ways of making that help available. And if our attitude is, it's my way or the highway, we're probably not going to ever find any middle ground. And the same thing must be true for so many other issues. The perceptions of needs are often shared by many of us. We have to learn to talk and to listen better to how those needs might be met. We all have to learn to reach out better in order to be better connected, because it's in those connections that we will be saved in the end. It's in the connections. I don't have to agree with someone in order to accept that they are capable of having good reasons or good intentions. Nor is anyone served if I believe that my political opinion comes out of a more educated or a more intelligent perspective. No one is served if I have the attitude that my views are beatific while other views are satanic or malevolent. I have to be open to the possibility that nearly half of the people in this country are not pig-headed evildoers. Being open to that possibility means that I have to be prepared to be earnest and vulnerable with others in conversation. And conversation which can occur if we both want it to, and if we are both seeking understanding and not conversion of the other. And it is incumbent upon us to want to be in such conversation. Our national character depends upon it. Our souls depend upon it. What an opportunity for liberal religionists such as ourselves to practice what we preach by taking our religious value of honoring the inherent worth and dignity of every person into the political arena of personal relationships. If such an idea of this kind of dialogue for understanding and not for persuasion catches on with the average citizen of our country, who knows? Maybe even our politicians could learn to work together. The key element for each of us in all of this is to be prepared. If we want to keep the task of picking up the pieces and moving on from being totally insurmountable, we will need to be prepared for these conversations. We'll need to be prepared to reach out, to be open, and to be vulnerable. I suspect, to a significant extent, it's like preparing for a storm. Some of that preparation is about letting go of the idea that any one or any few of us is or are in control. We are not in control. We are merely participants in the ongoing evolution of history, but we can at least choose how we might want that history to read, and then we can act within the sensibilities of those values that prompted our choice. Picking up the pieces and moving on. The storm. So in the wake of the maelstrom of our presidential election, we might want to speak about weather-related storms. We know something about those, too, of late. Everyone here has at least one, if not several, Hurricane Sandy stories. It's been something of an epic event that we've shared these past couple of weeks, collectively as a community and individually as well. For many of us, our power supplies and our communication system have been or were gone for varying lengths of time. Some of us incurred far more property damage than others. I'm so grateful to be able to say that I've heard of no one in our congregation who was actually injured or whose life was devastated by the storm. Instead, we have been fortunate collectively to have suffered only varying degrees of inconvenience and stress, really. We all know that not far from here, the losses were far more severe. We can count our blessings, and then we can share those blessings with others who are less fortunate. There's a way, I think, of looking at this storm experience on a spiritual level that makes it quite similar to our election experience. If we hope not to be annihilated by any storm, political or climatic, we need to do whatever we can in order to be prepared for it. That doesn't mean denying its approach. It means taking real steps of preparation. I'm guessing by this point, most of us could recite a litany of prep steps for storms: stored water, candles, flashlights and batteries, transistor radios, filled gas tanks, for some of us having carpet shampooing equipment on the ready, all the rest of it. We know that sometimes we will prepare all of these things and then we won't even need them. That's okay, because especially now we also know that the opposite, not being prepared and then learning that we should have been, isn't nearly as good as having been prepared in vain. But there's an even bigger part of the preparation that I think might be just as or even more important. We can get everything that we can think of as ready as possible, but the last step, as the storm starts blowing, is preparing to let go. We need to do all that we can to be prepared, and then we just have to let go of the outcome. We can't know if a tree or a limb from a tree is going to come crashing through our roof or through a window. We can't know. We can't predetermine what's going to happen in any kind of a storm. We aren't in control. We are merely participants in an ageless process of both nature and history, which will have its way, regardless of our wishes. But again, we can at least choose how we will want our history to read. And then we can act within the sensibilities of those values that prompted our choosing. I'll never forget the people of Greensboro, Kansas. I met them on my bicycle ride 2 years after the tornado came through and totally almost annihilated the village of Greensboro. What endured for those tough-spirited people despite that storm, though, was an implacable inclination toward hope, unyielding determination toward hope. It permeated the air of Greensboro both at the time of the tornado and still 2 years later when I visited them. I don't believe their hopefulness was born in the moment that they lost all of their possessions. It was born of a spirit that had been cultivated. It was born of a spirit that had been nurtured. It was born of a spirit that had been prepared and then set free when it was needed. The extreme weather events in these past couple of years here in New Jersey tell us that if we are not in the midst of a storm at the moment, we are merely in the lull between storms. The events tell us if we find ourselves in that lull, we might do well to be about preparing our spirits and whatever other preparations we might need to make for whatever else might be coming, because surely something else is always on its way. So here's what we might take away from both of these events, the elections and the storms. We are not in control of what happens. We are part of what happens, part of the cause and part of the effect, but we aren't in control. That should provide us with a good dose of humility. And humility encourages us to reach out to others, both in preparation and in the aftermath of such major events. It is in the reaching out that we redeem our own suffering and that we become agents of healing and transformation for others and for our planet. Our response of picking up the pieces and moving on are mitigated, are made easier by our capacity to reach out in connection with that which is larger than ourselves. If God is love, we avail ourselves of that love. We avail ourselves, and we are healed when we reach out seeking to make healing possible for others. And we are left to do this after every kind of storm. We are left to do our very best work and then to let go of the outcome. And the time to prepare our lives is now, before this next election cycle begins. The time to prepare our lives is now before the next storm blows in. So let us make our choices carefully and caringly and thoughtfully. Let us learn to live and to act within the sensibilities of the values that prompt our choosing. May it be so. Our closing words by Sam Trumbauer. Every week we gather in this beautiful space to find peace, each week, words and music offer and celebrate peace with the hope of instilling it in us. So now take the peace you have found here back out into the world with you. Renewed in our faith and inspired to act, let us be the peacemakers the world aches for. And by being peacemakers, let us find the peace we long for. So go in peace, make peace, be at peace. May the prayers of our hearts and the songs of our lips shared in this holy hour of worship be with us now and in our days to come. As we extinguish our chalice, this worship comes to an end and our service begins. Blessed be and amen.